Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
This is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rocket from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, Viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is it a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh my God, it's early.
Now, I should probably reproduce this and then stick this music in at the end of that. From the bright side of the road, man, always. Joining me is the man, the legend himself, Kim Holmes. What is up?
Good morning, Marines everywhere. Mac, it's another day in paradise. It is magnificent here in beautiful downtown North Dakota, Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I got to tell you, it's going to get up to 25 degrees today.
Boom!
Boom, baby. Maybe a little hotter. And speaking of hot, is our hockey team. They're kicking ass and taking names on the way to the Penrose Cup. They're like 14-1 at home this year. They go into St. Cloud, Minnesota, University of St. Cloud, for a two-game set this weekend. It should be on CBS Sports tonight, so you'll get to watch another good hockey game, Mac.
Yeah, I got to watch. I got to watch him beat Denver last week, which I love because I don't like Denver. And even though I was just there, I like the city. In fact, Kim and I went to Denver together.
Yes, we did. I was just going
to
say.
Yeah, we went to see the regionals, and we, you know, Denver has this really cool downtown. They got the shuttle. But downtown's a pretty concentrated place the way they've developed it. And so we bounced around and then a quick shuttle over to there was a Pepsi Center at the time. I don't know what it is now.
Yep.
And, we had the best time.
We were behind Michigan.
Yeah. Like their goaltender.
We were like 5 goals down. It was 7-2 or 7-3. And we came back and beat them like a drum.
I don't know about a drum, but they won. It was a great game.
It was great. But it was the interview after the game with their coach, Red Berenson or something.
Yeah,
he was just a little crybaby.
No, he's miserable. And, he can be miserable.
Oh, God, he was terrible. You know, coaches kind of get along with him. They like him, but. Yeah, he whined, man. We spanked him. We went on to play the BC, I think, in the finals.
And lost.
In the same set arena and lost it.
Yeah. BC over the years has been kryptonite for the University of North Dakota. And Boston College. I mean, when you talk about the elite programs, Denver, Boston College, North Dakota, Michigan.
Used to be,
and but they'll crop up there every once in a while now. And Notre Dame has become an elite program, and so
Penn State, for gosh sakes,
Penn State. Minnesota used to be an elite program, is no longer. They moved to the Big Ten or Big 12, whatever the hell they call themselves these days, and they have not done that. Conference has not been good for them because the best hockey teams in the country play in. In
the WCHC.
Yeah, the WCHC is what they call it now. And Duluth has become a perennial power led by a former North Dakota player.
And coach.
Yeah, and coach, Scotty Sandlin. So good stuff. No, I watched him last Friday, so I'll keep my fingers crossed. I got to look and make sure that I can watch it, but fire it up.
Yeah.
One of the funny things, in fact, I was in Denver yesterday, and it was warming up there, and I thought, in the fall, when it gets to be 20, I used to think, how could I ever think that 20 degrees is warm? Right? Right? And then you go through the winter. And like, it's going to be 20 today. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. And then you move to North Dakota and you think, damn, I can wear shorts today.
Yeah, it's like, what? So it's funny. And people laugh because, I was born and raised there. Our kids weren't born and raised there. But, it's like 5 degrees and they're, they got a set of gloves on. And a cap on, and then they just have their coat and jeans on, and they go flying out the door. See you later. Like, all right, later.
Yeah.
Okay. No, but it is. You do get used to it. People say, oh, geez. In fact, my buddy who lives in Denver, he says, yeah, that's really cold. And I'm like, you know what? Believe it or not, man, you get used to it. I did. I miss it. I miss the different seasons,
Yeah.
Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes I do. What's new and exciting? Anything new and exciting in your world? Anything?
Well, we've got a starting date for the new steakhouse.
Ooh, when is it?
The construction starts in March. Just finishing up the kitchen design.
If I come up, can I come to the grand opening?
Oh, I hope so.
Well,
you'll definitely be invited.
Will you ask Harold if I can come?
I will ask Hal. You count on it. Okay. I'll invite you.
All right.
Will
you be my? Can I be your date?
Yes. No. Yeah.
Well, it depends.
For sure.
Depends if Miss B goes, and then I've got to stand in line.
I love bookends.
I got to stand in line to be your girl.
No.
It's all right. I've stood behind Bob for years.
It's
going
to be fun.
I've stood behind.
I hope it's in line with your lecture.
I would love that. I never heard back from anybody up there, but you know me, man. I will at some point. I just got the coolest email that dropped in out of the blue, Kim, about a guy who's a friend of his stopped at a car accident, he was driving by. And a car had hit a tree, and he looks, and the guy's out of his car, and he says, "Hey man, are you all right?" And the guy says, "He goes, I think so, but could you call 911? My son's still in the car." So this guy who's driving by is a Marine. He grabs a first aid kit in his car, and he begins to tend to the son, and the son made it, and he's going to be okay.
Oh,
But he was struggling with it. And the guy who listens to the program, said, what's going on? You're a little quiet today. And so the guy started telling him the story. And then he started quoting All Marine Radio. He looks at him and he says, you're never going to get over that, right? And he said, he just looked at me. And he started telling him stories about, hey, you can do this and you can do that. And so... I know the power of it. I was just in Denver doing it for the Space Force. I'll go next week. I'll go to Orlando, Florida, and do it for another Air Force group. And so, it's pretty cool. So I know it's just a matter of time till somebody in North Dakota says, I don't know that doing it in conjunction with the school district is a good thing, because the school district is such an uptight group of people, and this is not an uptight thing. This is a real thing, and it's probably a little.
Yeah, this is about living your life,
a great life, in spite of what comes into it, what comes into it, and it works, and I'm really proud of it. And what makes me even happier is when I'm just cruising along on a Friday morning, and all of a sudden I get an email like that from somebody who says, "Hey, I had the first opportunity to put into practice what I've heard you talk about." And two people got their lives changed, right? First of all, the guy who responded, right, he got his life changed. But
yes,
the guy, right, who the guy who his name's Anthony, who sent me the email, who sat down with this guy and talked to him, his life got changed too. He experienced the power of what it is when you have that Grinch moment, when your heart grows because you touch somebody's life. And so it's just, it's like straight up hippie cool. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do.
It's like hippie. It's like hippie.
I sure do. It's like hippie cool. That's a nice phrase. I like that.
It's like hippie.
I'll use that.
And then the other, you know, kind of cool thing that's gone on this week is we talked about, you know, 75 years ago, Marines went ashore on Iwo Jima in one of the signature battles of the Marine Corps in Marine Corps history. And, and they came from every walk of life, you know, all corners of the country, you know, to in America's, fight against Japan and Germany in World War II. And had their lives changed. Some had their lives ended. But, you know, the stories that these guys tell are just unbelievable. And you and I both grew up with them as our coaches. And, for those of you that don't know, Kim's dad flew a C-47 transport in the Normandy invasion. But it's 75 years ago.
Every European campaign, he dropped paratroopers.
That's awesome, man. Hey, those are like big ball events, man. Big ball events. So, no, as you think about, the audio I play, you know, there's a audio of a reporter doing play-by-play as they go to the beach. And at one point he stops and says, and I'm thinking of my wife and children right now, and I hope I get to see them again. You know, and you hear that, you know, this guy's doing live play-by-play, and you can hear like the ships shooting. As they head towards the beach and the unknown future, you know, that is that happens on that beach. So, so it's just, I know it's amazing stories, amazing stories about how they lived and then how they came home, right? And and resumed their life and dealt with this stuff in silence, right? Unlike the exact way that I say, don't do this. We've had people go down this road and it's a really hard, lonely road, but that's the only road that existed back then. And then the offshoot of that is use alcohol, you know, and get drunk. And a lot of people did that as well. So, but they were part of the greatest generation. Part of the greatest generation. So, very cool. Very cool. And then you and I knew a couple. I mean, Kim and I have a mutual friend who passed away a few years ago. His name's Tom Clifford. He was a tank company commander on Iwo Jima. And Tom Clifford was, he was a no shit guy, man. He was became the president of the University of North Dakota, and he was not afraid. Smart guy, tough guy, but not afraid of a confrontation. And always doing good things. And one of the nicest, kindest people you'll ever meet until you cross him.
Yeah. And you don't, this one of the stories about Tom was you'd be really pissed at him and you'd go into his office at the university and you were just furious. And you got off your chest what you had to say. And he says, every time I walked out of Tom's office, we were friends. He had his arm around me and we resolved our issues. And that's what he was famous for.
Yeah. And these are guys who did not get a major contract that they were bidding for with the university. And they were pissed.
Yeah.
And they'd go into his office to throw a fit and they'd walk out saying, that guy's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a straight shooter. He told me why he went this way. He was good.
Yeah. No, he's a great guy. And I've told the story before, but so a friend of mine brought me these cassette tapes of live broadcasts of World War II. And I'm listening to them, and it starts doing the Iwo Jima segment. And I'm listening, and the guy says, I think you know somebody that's in this. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, I think Tom Clifford is in this. And it was somebody had recorded the communications between the tanks, and you can hear his voice. And they call it, you know, they weren't, they didn't work on encrypted nets, and but they operated in the clear, and they had nicknames for each other, you know. So you hear this guy called, they called Java Joe, right? And he's calling Tom, which is Tom Clifford, you know. Tom's tank was eight ball, and spelled with I want to say with an A, because they were Alpha Company, and of the 4th Tank Battalion. And so anyway, you hear him talking. So I had him on my program on the anniversary, and I don't have the interview anymore, and it makes me, it crushes me that I don't have it. But
yeah,
and I hadn't told him I had the audio, and I said, I want you to listen to something. And so he and I are sitting in my studio in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I hit play, and he's listening to it, and his eyes got big. And then they got normal, and you could see him go someplace else.
Yeah.
And when it ends, he looks at me, and I said, could you explain what was going on? And he said, where in God's name did you get that? And I told him the story. And I said, have you never heard it? He said, the last time I heard it was when it came through my headset in that tank. And
wow.
Yeah, it was the coolest. It was just an incredible moment. He said, well, you know, we got to the beach. We got told we probably weren't going to go ashore because they had pounded Iwo Jima, you know, pretty good, they thought. He's unbeknownst to anybody, you know, it didn't have much effect. And so, the grunts go ashore and they're immediately, you know, stopped by everything that's still there. And so, yeah. You know, we got told we're going ashore, and, you know, we had engineers that had found lanes and marked lanes through up the beach. And he said, you know, the beach was really steep. You know, he said, I don't know, you get that sense from the aerial images, but when you down on the beach, I mean, that thing is like 45 degrees up. And so we found places and they marked lanes where we could get through. And then we got up there and we were trying to find each other. And he said, you can imagine just the craziness. He said, and that's what you're hearing. We're up there looking for each other. You know, and, you know, if you were up there in a tank, you caught holy hell, you know, and,
wide open.
Yeah. And he said, and then the flame tanks, especially, because they knew that that was bad news. And so, but it was the most unbelievable interview. And he was a great guy. He was still in his 70s. You know, he was this incredibly fit guy. He played handball all the time.
Handball.
Yeah. And I used to give him a tough time. I'd say, you know, I'd ask him, I'd say, how old are you really? He's like, he'd say, I'm 82. I'm like, you're not 82. You know, the rest of these people, because you're a big shot, they might believe you're bullshit. I don't. How old are you really? You're like 75. He'd start laughing. He'd say, what? I said, you heard me. Like, I'm a Marine. I don't play these games with other Marines. Okay. How old are you really? And he'd start laughing. And, but you know what? And he was always.
And he'd get that twinkle in his eye, man. Right. And that little Irish twinkle.
And I remember, I don't know which time I'd come home from. He saw me someplace, and he comes over to me. And he sees me, and we shake hands, and he asks me how I'm doing. And he asks me how things were. And I forget if it was I was coming home from Iraq or Afghanistan. And then he looked at me, and he said, how are you doing? And I said, I think I'm okay. And he said, he looked at me, and he said, hey, if you ever need anybody to talk to, he said, you come down. He said, just give me a call. And I said, thank you. You know, it's just, and it was somebody from his greatest generation, you know, let me know that they're, you know, that you are going to probably have some issues. And I remember asking him, I said, you know, hey, you know, as fit as you are at 82, what were you like after you'd come home from the war and started to go back to work? And he said, oh, you don't want to know. He said, you could ask some of the retired guys on Grand Forks Police Department. He said, you know, they found me a few times staggering down the railroad tracks. And it wasn't pleasant either because I wasn't having any of their bullshit. I was like, oh, yeah. He said, no. He said, no. He said, but you know what? They were great to me. They used to handcuff me and throw me in the car and take me home, right, and kick me out on my lawn. And never say a word about it. Never say a word about it. He said, but
and then never did.
Right. And he said, but I had some problems, obviously, which were made worse, you know, by I came home and I was drinking. And until I stopped doing that, those things would happen.
Yeah.
And then he tells an awesome story about and his secretary emailed me once and said he tells you stuff that I've never heard him talk about. And one of the stories is that he gets in the Marine Corps because this guy, another guy who rises in to be a very prominent North Dakota politician named Evan Lipps. Evan Lipps joins the Marine Corps, and Tom Clifford knew Evan Lipps from college at the University of North Dakota. So Lipps says, hey, if you got to go fight, you want to go fight with the Marines. So Clifford's like, okay, I'll join the Marines. So he winds up on Guadalcanal late in the battle, and then he becomes a tank guy in the Battle of Saipan. Well, the Japanese bury aviation ordnance in the ground, and they put an anti-tank mine on top of it. So this is probably about 1,000 pounds of TNT, right?
Yep.
That explode underneath his tank. It detaches the turret that Tom's in from the hull of the tank, and Tom gets blown. The turret separates from the tank, and then Tom gets blown out of the turret. As he's ejected from the turret, he's cut by the butterfly handles on the 50 caliber machine gun, for those of you that can visualize that. And his chest is ripped open from like his sternum to like below his belly button. And so he ultimately winds up in an open-air hospital. It's got some kind of masonry walls, and his stretcher is on like these two sawhorses, and that's the operating room. And he said, the guys are operating our battalion surgeon, so I know both of them. It's like, that's Larry, and that's, and that's Joe. And he said they had run out of general anesthetic. So they were giving me local anesthetic, right? And they're talking to me while they're doing it. So I'm laying on the stretcher. I could see the sky above, and they're talking to me. And they're telling me, like, Tom, you're going to be okay. You know, we've got to sew you up. We don't have any general anesthetic. We're using local. We'll do the best we can. And then one of them says, hey, Tom, you know, he said, so my stomach and everything is like everything's laid open. And one of them looks down and says, hey, Tom, your appendix looks pretty bad. Do you care if we take it out? And he says, no. He says, no, go ahead. And then he says, I feel this like snip, right? And then I hear this plop as they throw my appendix in a bucket or something. And he said, so I got two for one that day. They sewed me up and I got my appendix taken out. And in an open air hospital, right, while the fighting's going on. So, I mean, he tells these unbelievable stories. Then, you know, he got nursed back to health and then, went to the next fight on Iwo Jima. So, I mean, incredible people, right? And, you know, people that were, I used to call them heroes in our midst. Don't even know it. You know, they don't talk about it a bunch. And until somebody tells you that, you know, they do that in silence. So, pretty cool stuff. I've got an email for you. Mac, if you don't mind, I've got a email question for the chef.
Yep.
And then it says this. It's more of a comment than a question. I did steaks the way the chef instructed to do them, and I just want to tell him they were the best steaks I've ever eaten in my life. Thank you. You know, I'm going to confess to this too. I, for whatever reason, Kim, I don't put as much charcoal as I should in my grill.
Yes.
And so ultimately, I'll use the digital meat thermometer, and I'll wind up cooking, because it's not hot enough, I have to keep the steak over direct heat, right, longer to get it to cook. Well,
yes.
I was, I don't know, a week or two ago, I had a gift certificate from a butcher shop in Newport Beach for Christmas.
Yeah.
And so Colleen and I go down there and we pick out a ribeye steak and we come home and I was putting charcoal in and I kind of screwed it up and I put way too much.
Yeah.
And, but I thought, I'm not going to put it back in the bag. I'll just use it. And so I had too much charcoal in. Well, it seared the steak really well on both sides. Then I put it on the indirect heat. And I did what the person did just a couple weeks ago. And, oh, my God, I learned a lesson.
It was deluxe.
Follow the directions.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, the steak, the ribeye, I want to say was $26 a pound.
Yep, that's about right.
If you're going to – eating good steak starts with a good steak. And again, you could buy like a $10 steak at the store, and that'll be okay. But just know that you're operating at a lower level. If you want to have a great steak, go start with a great steak, and then don't screw it up.
That's right.
But you want to just go over steak cooking and instructions one more time in case somebody's never heard them.
Well, you have to. Get the steak to room temperature. No matter what you're cooking, chicken, pork, steak, fish, it's got to be at room temperature, because when you throw it on the grill or in the skillet, if it's cold right out of the fridge, it takes more heat to bring the inner temperature down. If it's at room temperature and you've got something kick-ass hot, you sear it. And you sear it on one side.
Let me ask you a question. So, olive oil and seasoning.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Olive oil both sides before it goes on the grill, and then season both sides before it goes on the grill. How do you do it?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
A half an hour before you throw it on the grill, most chefs will just salt it. They won't put any pepper. They'll salt it all over. Very generous.
No pepper.
And that kind of draws out the moisture. But you can, if you olive oil it, and I do personally, because I like that flavor when you sear it with the olive oil, the salt, and pepper. I'm a pepper guy. But it's got to be kosher salt and fresh ground black pepper, and you on your pepper mill, you have three settings: fine, medium, and coarse. You put it on the coarse because you want chunks of pepper going on that puppy, and so you liberally pepper it, salt it, but you gently rub the olive oil on it, not a lot. You don't just put gobs of it on. Just put a little on this one side and rub it with your hand in before you salt and pepper, and do it on the ends and the side, and then flip it and do the same thing. And then you let it sit for another half an hour in a plate, and then you take it out to your grill, which is smoking hot, and you say for conversation, we're doing a 2-inch ribeye that weighs maybe 2 pounds.
That's a pretty big steak, right?
Yes, it is. The 2 inches makes it a big steak,
right?
Or 2.5 inches, but whatever it is. And then you slap it on, not slap it, you put it on with your tongs in the hottest part, and you sear it for 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes. Then you flip it, and you want to get a crust on the steak, and then you flip it and do the same thing. Now, if you want to get grill marks on it, you take a minute and a half one way, and then you turn it 45 degrees, same side down on the grill, for another minute and a half. And then you flip it and repeat that. And then you set it off on the indirect heat. Now, indirect heat is, say you've got a charcoal grill and you've got a fire on one side and you've got nothing except indirect heat. You know, it's a kettle cooker or a Weber with a gas grill that has a dome.
Right.
But one of the burners is totally off.
Right.
It's still plenty hot. Now, when you start, all the burners are on, 110%. They're just all – and then when you put the steak on, that indirect burner, you turn off. Now, it'll still be warm, plenty warm enough to burn the hell out of your hand. But the temperature will drop completely on it. And now, and then
now let me tell you, you get the heat. One of the things Kim and I have done a show about is if you're a charcoal person still like I am, you can buy inserts for your grill.
Yes, you can.
Depending on your grill, you know, you just go online and you'll see all these different shaped baskets. Some are like a crescent for a circular, you know, bottom. Some are a rectangle. Some are a square. That way, you just fill that thing up with charcoal, and that way, you know, you have your, you know, you have your segregated grill, you know, one side, you know, with a lot of charcoal with all the heat you need, and then the other side is vacant. Or I don't have one of those. I just kind of do it. I just pile it on one side and then get after it.
Well, you've got the big green egg, so you're in a different class than a lot of folks.
Yeah, baby.
You're in the front row. No. That's where you are.
Well, I got that because of Kim. Kim talks so much shit about the green egg. Right? And now I'll tell you what. Somebody who listened to the program went out and bought one. And he said, that's my Sunday ritual now. Ribeyes on the green egg. Awesome.
Yep. And boy, if I'm sure they'll get into putting a pork butt on there one weekend, Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon and leave it on overnight for 12 hours. So you can have it the Sunday at a party, or you do it Friday before you go to work for a Saturday party. Friday night when you get home, you put it on and cook it overnight in the big green egg.
Right.
I'm telling you. And then you have pulled pork sandwiches. You're in the front row.
Yeah. But, you know, and you know, once you get it seared, the rest, I mean, if you have a digital meat thermometer, the rest is easy.
Yes.
You know, if you don't, you got to be a pro like Kim and have a calibrated thumb. So that you can,
that has a big callus on the end.
Yeah, exactly. but I mean, that's what it takes, because if you don't, go about and buy a digital meat thermometer. I'm telling you, it's impossible to screw it up if you do that. And you just sit there and you watch it on your Bluetooth, thing on your phone, on the little app that you can get from Weber. And, once you do that, it tells you, and you take it off. Right. When it, like, if you want your steak medium rare, as Kim has taught me, you take it off when it's rare, and you're going to wrap it in foil and let it sit for 10 minutes so the juices all settle. And it's going to go from medium rare. And if you can keep the, you know, thermometer in and watch it if you want to, but it's going to go from medium rare to medium or rare to medium rare in that period of time.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's.
Yes, it will. And you want to pull it out when it's about 120 max. And it'll be rare. It'll be bloody inside. And then in 10 minutes, it'll still cook. And how that works is the center is cold. But when you cook something on a grill, it cooks from the outside in. And the inside pulls the heat in. So when it's resting, that cool center still pulls in the heat from the steak around it and finishes it medium rare. And that's why you do that.
Got it.
There you go.
Well, and now, I'm just going to tell you, I was embarrassed when this happened to me, what happened with the writer, what the emailer said. I mean, I was like, this is kind of stupid. Like, and I don't know why I didn't, like, it's not like I care about charcoal, and it's not like that shit's that expensive. But I did, for just on a stupid thing, I didn't, you know, I didn't do it right. And then I did by accident, right? I was like, what an idiot, right? Yeah. What an absolute idiot. Yeah. So anyway, live and learn, live and learn.
Yep.
All right. Here's another question.
Yes.
I heard you guys a couple weeks ago talking about the food that your mother's cooked. One of the things one of you said was goulash, which took me back to being a kid and going to my grandmother's house and having goulash. Does the chef have a recipe for goulash?
No, I don't. Handy, I have one, but what you do for goulash is you have stew meat. Right. Usually,
what is stew? What is stew meat?
It's a sirloin that's cut into chunks. You can go to the butcher store and you'll see it in a case, and you'll say, "Okay, give me," you figure about a half a pound per person, and then you order, if there's four of you, give me 2 pounds of stew meat, and you take them home. You make sure that they're patted dry. Then you dredge them in flour. You put them in the your Dutch oven or a deep-sided saute pan. You brown it. You brown it. Then you take out the meat. You sit it on a plate. You deglaze the inside, I do, with a little red wine, about a cup of red wine. You cook that down about halfway. You throw your onions in with a little more, with a little bit of butter, and start browning those onions and caramelizing them, getting so they're translucent. And then you put the meat back in. You throw your stock in. You can use chicken stock or beef stock, and you can buy them in cartons. If you don't make your own, which most of us don't, and then you put a lid on it. You know, you add your seasoning, you get it the flavor, and you reduce it and tenderize it. In the last half hour, you put in your cream. Some people use milk, or I put in cream. And the cream, when it cooks down, thickens. So you should, and don't forget, you've had flour on those pieces of meat, and that will help make a gravy also, from dusting your meat with flour before you brown them. And then if you, some people love mushrooms. I'm one of them in my stroganoff. Wait, we're talking about mushrooms.
Hold on, we're talking about goulash.
Goulash, yeah.
No mushrooms.
Goulash.
No mushrooms in goulash. Yeah. Well, goulash is, you can put anything in goulash, right?
Yeah, you can. But usually there's paprika in goulash. You can use smoked paprika or sweet paprika with your onions. Okay? I forgot to add those. Went off on a little riff there.
So let me tell you what we used to have in our goulash. It was noodles. It was stewed tomatoes. It was it was meat. I would say either peas or corn or a vegetable was in there.
Yeah.
What else? And there was always an onion, certainly in there. Those were Kathleen's. When I think of it, those are Kathleen's major ingredients. I might have the recipe.
I'm going to look up my recipe too. I'll have it next Friday.
I might have the recipe right here.
But I use the egg noodles, and they're about quarter inch, half inch wide, and maybe 3 or 4 inches long. And that's what you put the goulash on.
Oh, my God. And it's thick. Hold on. Here's my mom's goulash.
Oh, great.
Recipe. Holy shit. 1 to 1.25 pounds of ground beef. One medium onion. One large, or it's like, might be half of a green onion, half of a green pepper.
Yeah.
1/4 pound of mushrooms. One can of medium 14-ounce stewed tomatoes.
Yeah.
one small or regular kernel whole corn with juice, a small package of egg noodles, two small cans of tomato sauce, five slices of American cheese, brown meat, and drain the fat. Hold on. I got to get to part two. Drain the fat and the green with, so you're browning the meat, the mushrooms, and the green peppers all together. You're going to drain the fat and put them in. Mix together beef and veggies. Put in Dutch oven. Stir in remaining ingredients. Put cheese across the top. Cover, cook 1 hour at 350. Great with salad and bread.
There you go. There you go.
That's Kathleen's goulash recipe. And how funny is that?
That's awesome. Tremendous. Way to go.
But isn't it like it can? It's whatever you want to be, right? Goulash.
Yeah, I mean, it really is.
Wasn't there a category on Jeopardy called goulash, which was anything?
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
Hungarian goulash is.
Hungarian goulash for 20.
Ground beef, chunk, stew meat, any damn thing you want. Pork. You knock yourself out.
Yeah, go crazy.
And that's one of those dishes that is not very expensive to do.
Well, that's what you remember. I mean, we had a really cool conversation when we were talking about these recipes. One of the things Kim and I, you know, were talking about was families were bigger. You know, we had four kids, and I was like, well, why don't we have more kids? You know, and so you were constantly, mothers didn't work, right? So, you know, the things you ate had to be able to be prepared for a large number of people. I mean, there was like, for us, six of us sitting down to dinner every night, six mouths to feed. And, you know, and a lot of families bigger than ours. And so the art of cooking that our mothers did was, you know, tuna casserole, right? Or cream tuna. I mean, that was on toast, right? A can or two of tuna and, you know, flour, milk, salt, pepper, whatever you'd seasoned with, and simmer it, and you're making, and it's that's what goulash is. That's what beef stroganoff is, right?
Yep. And sometimes you'd get potato chips on your tuna casserole and crunch them up in a bag. And sprinkle them on the top towards the end of baking it. And it was made it even better.
But, you know, yeah, it was. No, but it was, there was an art to it. And you don't really realize it till you start to consider, right, that's what was going on with bigger families on a budget. Mom stayed at home and all of that. And that's how they that's how we ate. You know, Kim and I were laughing, fish sticks on Friday or cream tuna or something like that. And I remember.
Or on bowling night for me, TV dinners.
Bowling nights?
Yeah, for my parents, every Wednesday go bowling. They were in a league.
Really?
During the bowling season. And we got to pick TV dinners, Swanson TV dinners. We had our favorites.
No, I was joking about that, right? How different.
Yeah, we were.
How different, you know, life was when we were raised. And which is one of the problems that now with kids, and kids aren't any different, but the world they grow up. I mean, imagine, instead of growing up with your mom home every day, you go to daycare for 8 hours a day. And are the kids the same every day? No, they're different. Are the people that take care of you the same every day? No, they're different. And so, I mean, imagine that. You know, our loving mothers who took care of us, who fed us, who did all that stuff in our homes. You know, young kids don't, you know, tend to not grow up like that anymore, unless you're really wealthy and you can hire somebody to take care of your kid. But the average kid's going to daycare, right? And so, I mean, they grow up a lot different than we do. And so it's just when you give it some thought and you think about the food that we ate and the number of mouths that sat at the table and the fact that there was only one income, you know, and how you made all that work. It's pretty, you know, it makes you smile when you think about it. And, but pretty cool.
Makes you proud of your parents because, that was not easy easy doings back then.
No. Here's one of my mom's favorite things that she would make. They're beef sandwiches. This is what my friends would come over and they would eat these to death. It's a pound to a pound and a half of ground beef. 1 8-ounce can of tomato sauce, 1 medium chopped onion, 1/4 pound of sliced mushrooms, 1 green pepper, 1 green onion, 1 tablespoon of butter, and then brown and drain the ground beef, saute the veggies in margarine, drain, and then season the meat. All right. Season the meat with soy sauce, garlic salt, Lowry's salt, pepper, onion powder, Worcestershire sauce. Mix the vegetables and the meat and add the tomato sauce. Slice the rolls 3/4 of the way through, unless they're already sliced. Stuff the rolls with the meat mixture. Cut a piece of American cheese diagonally. Place it on the meat. Wrap each separately in foil. Bake at 350 for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You can make ahead of time and freeze them. Excuse me. Thaw before cooking, though. Serve with onion rings or homemade French fries. My mom would make homemade French fries, the big ones where she would where she would quarter a potato long ways. And then oh, my God.
You're in the front row.
My mom would make these things, and my friends would drop what they were doing. They would leave work. I'm sick. I got to go home. And they would come to my house. They would come to our house and eat these things. And they were awesome. They were absolutely awesome. But again, right, pretty basic stuff, pretty basic concoction that my mom would make. And that to me is the art form of our mothers, is that it was pretty basic food that they made to taste delicious that we wound up loving, which is part of what I love about doing this with Kim is we'll talk about the history of food and where different dishes come from and doing it on a budget and how you made it taste great and how different cultures did that. And it's, I think it's the history of food to me is very interesting. And I'm not a foodie per se, you know, but I really do enjoy it.
You are now. You are a foodie.
Well,
now.
I mean, Kim's story.
But not in a snobbish way, Mac.
In an eating
way. In an inquisitive way.
Right. Kim's story about the Caesar salad. You know, all the different rabbit holes we've gone down relative to different dishes and things like that, I mean, to me, are all fascinating in terms of how does a culture make something, make a dish, and make it taste absolutely delicious. And then you find that, you know, it evolved over decades as they took the stuff that nobody else wanted, learn how to slow cook it or learn how to, you know, pound it with a mallet and soften it and then do this to it and then put this seasoning in it. And pretty soon they had something that everybody wanted to eat. But it starts out as we're trying to make do with no money and collard greens. Right. Kim was talking about how tough they are when you get them. Right. Non-edible.
And how long you have to cook them.
Right.
And you throw a ham hock in there or a pork knuckle or something, you're in the front row.
But again, that was something that other people wouldn't eat.
No, wouldn't touch them. Until I remember when I had Marvinia's collard greens. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I guess I was about 6.5, 7 years old.
Who's Marvinia?
Marvinia, marvelous Marvinia. She was a lady that took care of me after my father died, and I was with my grandparents. My mom was not doing so well at the time. And so I stayed with and Marvinia was the housekeeper.
Wow.
In Hagerstown, Maryland. And her husband was a Baptist preacher, and I would Marvinia would cook this food, and I would eat it up, you know, like real fried chicken and that stuff. And cooking for my grandparents and her family, there were four kids. Most of them are off. Mom was married, of course, and they were all married except my Uncle Derek. And, oh, God, the food was so good, and it was cheap. I didn't know it at the time. But she would take me to church Sunday, and that's when I heard my first electric guitar.
Oh, really?
At a Baptist, her husband. Yeah, and the singing, and here I'm a little towhead at the time, 6 and a half, 7 years old, jumping up and down in the first row with Marvina and her husband up there. Hallelujah. And it was fabulous, man. That's why I joke, you know, I became a fabulous dancer, I would think. I always joke, yeah, I'm a black man trapped in a white body.
There you go. No, but you know, it's funny, you know, because, you know, you would, that's not a culture that you got a glimpse into as a kid, right? And then all of a sudden you meet this woman, Marvina, and, you know, you're bouncing around, and she says, something like, Kimmy, I'm going to cook for you some of my food. And you sit down and you're like, oh my God, what is this? Right? What is this? And
I didn't know what sweet potato pie was.
Well, not even
she cooked one,
right? And you, but again, they're how did these things evolve and the history of it?
Yep.
I've always found, you know, since Kim and I have done this, is fascinating how different dishes grow. And even like we've talked about, you know, I remember we were talking about different like Italian meats, and I remember asking Kim. I asked him. I said, why? You know, why do all these, you know, why does Italy like have like all these different meats like salami and prosciutto and all this stuff? And then he said, well, that's the way they preserved it. They had to, because of the climate and the humidity, that's the way they learned to preserve meat to get it to last through the winter. And so you like, oh,
that's right.
They used salt. Right, to cure the outside, and that was a preservative. And then they'd wrap it with paper, and that's how they got their meat to last through the winter. And you're like,
And then they'd take fish, and they'd pack it in salt, the baklava, and they'd dry it and salt it, and you have to run water over it for about two or three days. To get all the salt out, and then they'd cook it and bring it back to life. And they'd add tomatoes or whatever. You thought you'd died and gone to heaven. My time spent in Europe and learning about the cultures and how they preserved the foods and why they did it, it was fascinating for me. It made me a better cook.
I'm like you. I find it fascinating, you know.
I did too.
When you look at the evolution of a culture's food, see, you know, what they had to work with, right, and what was inexpensive, and then how these dishes evolved, right? It was, you know, trying to feed, you know, whoever, how many kids in your family, and families tended to be big.
On a
very limited budget, and yet still have something that tasted good. Which there are all around the world. So, well, in most places, not so much in Ireland. You never hear anybody say, "Let's eat Irish tonight." So I don't know. I don't know why the Irish got skipped over when it came to food, but it's not their whiskey. Yes, food. No,
food. Well, no. Because of the famine, the potato famine.
Look, we had
Ireland.
In. We had a lot of years to work on the culinary side that we didn't seem to make too much. Corned beef and cabbage, really? That's what we got. That's our gift to the world. Come on.
Which is one of the great dishes in ever. No, corned please. Beef and cabbage.
I don't think so. Yeah, whatever.
I do.
No, I don't. Here's an email. Hey, Mac, I want to hear how the chef would fry big French fries like your mom made. What kind of oil and what kind of seasoning would he use? So start even before that. What kind of potato would you use? Does it make a difference?
Well, I don't think you use a russet, use a red, use any damn potato you want. It's whatever's freshest, closest to you, wherever you live. And, you know, you rinse them, you wash them. I'm a skin guy. I like leaving the skins on. You take out the eyes, those little, you know, they're called eyes.
You take
a potato peeler and you scoop them out.
The root. Are those roots, right?
The roots, yeah.
But we call them.
And some people will take a potato and peel it completely. And then if you do that, you dump them in a thing of water, a bucket of water, until you're ready to cut them up and then pat them dry. Because if you don't, they'll turn brown on you. Same with making mashed potatoes. We would cut our potatoes up, throw them in a 10-gallon bucket, fill them with water, and then the next day we'd come in, drain them, fill them up with cold water, and then boil them and mash them. But for me, to fry potatoes, you can cook them on the stovetop in oil if you want. I like baking them. And I like seasoning them. You can use Lowry's seasoning salt, Old Bay salt, just salt and pepper. That's all you need. And you cut them in wedges lengthwise.
Right.
And you can make them real big. You can quarter them, or you can do eighths. Depends on how small you want them.
What do you like? What do you like? You're making French fries for you.
I like, say I've got a big red potato.
Yeah.
Weighs about a half to a pound. You know, it's a long one.
Right.
They're usually rounder, but I would leave the skins on. I would quarter them and then maybe cut them in half, each quarter in half again. So there's plenty of meat in each wedge. And then I would turn the oven on probably 3 1/4. not too hot. And then I'd oil them, salt and pepper them, throw them on a baking sheet with parchment paper. Please put parchment paper on your baking sheet so they don't stick and it's easy cleanup. Okay? And then you spread them out so there's a lot of air in between them. And then I'd throw them in the oven and for about 45 minutes to an hour. And then pull them out and they've got a crust on them on the outside. And then the inside should be nice and tender.
Yeah, that's how my mom did it. I think that she used a lot of Lowry's, you know, seasoning salt.
And
but she would just quarter the potato. She wouldn't cut it again. And you only needed, you know, if you got four of those, that means you ate the whole potato, right? And so you didn't. I mean, between that and the sandwich was like awesome. No, that's how she made them. And my mom was not a big, like, she did not make fried chicken. You know, she baked her chicken. And that was the only thing I can recall seeing her fry like that. And, you know, she would fry them. And man, my mom, her recipes, not very complicated, but the food was awesome. The food was awesome.
Yeah.
And French fries, right? With enough salt and then ketchup all over the place, you know, something cold, cold and carbonated to drink. It was, it was a great meal.
But it depends on the size of the potato, whether you cut them in quarters or eighths.
Right.
But generally quarters are the way you'd get a wedge of potato.
Yeah. No, let me tell you. And it's better French fry eating than those little string things, you know, scooping them up and fighting them. Now you got the big, robust French fry. You're like, yeah, this is about time. Poosh.
Yeah.
Throw that thing, and throw that thing down your gullet.
Try those with a big ribeye. Oh. Try those kind of French fries that you're doing the ribeye on your grill, and the French fries you can do in the oven. And man, you'll be in the front row. And that's for sure.
All right. All right, Kim. Anything else you want to get off your chest before we end our therapy session today?
Well, I'm just good luck, Sue, tonight. I hope you get it on your TV screen. It'll be a great game. You know, St. Cloud has the big sheet.
Yeah, we don't like that.
But they have a big sheet at the Ralph to practice on.
Yeah.
So they're going to be prepared. It should be a fabulous game. I think if they... they've got six games left. I think they've got two at St. Cloud. Then Western Michigan comes in here next week. And then we finish the season in Omaha down there. And then the tournament starts.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's getting close, baby. Only it starts in March.
That's right.
You remember that?
No. Well,
we have some good times watching that hockey team.
No, it was always good. It was before North Dakota State's football team got to be good, right? This was the team that the state rallied around because it would go to the national tournament and win national championships and they won a lot of them. And so it was always a ton of fun to go. And people from North Dakota would travel all over the country to go see the team play. But it was just a good time. It was a party where...
They still do.
Yeah, it was a party wherever it happened. And just nice people, good people, and most of them farmers, right? And run small businesses and just salt of the earth people. So it was always made for a great time. And Kim and I, I would go do my radio show and then the rest of the day screw off. Kim and I would go screw off. Then we'd go to the games and just had a wonderful time. So it was always good stuff. So always fun.
Yeah, we had good seats.
Always fun. Always fun to watch a hockey game. All right, bud. Thank you very much for the visit.
You have a great weekend.
I will.
My love to your children.
You bet. I will do that.
And I'll see everyone next week.
All right, bud. Have a great one.
You too. Bye-bye.
There you have it. That is the one and only, my hetero life partner, P. Kimball Holmes. All right, if you're just tuning in, first hour is pretty cool. In the middle of it, somebody sends me an email. And his name's Anthony. And Anthony sends me an email about changing somebody's life. And for the first time, he had an opportunity to use the thing that he's learned listening to All Marine Radio for a couple of years and put them to practice. And he did. There's no way to put into words how happy stuff like that makes me. That the stuff that I know to be true, the stuff that I go around the country and talk about, that on a daily basis, you know, people that have heard it put that stuff into motion and change people's lives. And I played the audio from a Jewish rabbi. Abraham Twersky, Twersky, and that depending on how we look at stress, we can either grow from it, right, or we can numb ourselves to it and attempt to endure it. Okay, so if you modify that a little bit, I would tell you this. Depending on how you approach traumatic events, you can either grow from it, right? You can attempt to numb yourself to it, which tends not to work, or you can fake it, right? And I will tell you this. In fact, I just had an epiphany. Interstate 3. So Interstate 1 is I don't have trauma. Interstate 2, right, is I don't talk about it. I fake it. I throw it in the closet. And a lot of people deal with it like that. Interstate 3 is alcohol, drugs. Now, some of those drugs can be prescription drugs. But essentially what you're doing is you're numbing yourself to it. That's how you're going to deal with it. And then the fourth path, the entrance is you got to confront the truth. And once you begin to come, it's like Brigadoon. Once you begin to confront the truth, it materializes. Brigadoon shows up. And the people standing there to greet you are Admiral James Stockdale, Brigadier Jenny, Brigadier General Robinson Risner from the United States Air Force, both Hanoi Hilton guys, and they're beckoning you. If you'll confront the truth, you can come down this path. And it's a path to a greater life. And so that's what the rabbi says. So anyway, so you'll hear that in hour one. Right out of the blue. And then you'll hear my playlist that I decided to share with everybody. And then you'll hear a few stories. And then the chef joined us. And we talked a little bit about friends that we've met over the course of our lives, that are veterans of Iwo Jima, which 75 years ago this week happened. The flag raising happened 75 years ago on Sunday, right? The iconic flag raising, and the battle rages for another month. So, so we talked about that, and then talked about actually doing, and I had somebody emailed and I said I had the same experience, but actually doing it the way that the chef says. So get the steak to room temperature, oil it, all right, season it, right, rub the seasoning, whatever you use. If it's just salt and pepper, I use the Montreal steak seasoning, which I like, and you know, rub that on both sides. That way when you're grilling, you're not trying to shake it on, right? So anyway, do that, and then get one side of your grill on high, sear that thing on both sides. And that's what I wasn't doing. I wasn't getting it hot enough. So I wind up, you know, cooking it, watching the digital temperature. And it was good, but it's not as good as when you actually follow the directions, which means you need a lot of heat. You need a lot of heat. And the Incredible Egg is great because it's shaped like an egg, right? So there's a lot of vertical distance between the charcoal and the steak. So, you know, you can have it really hot. Ribeye's got a lot of fat content, which creates a little bit of flame, but it doesn't impact the steak because there's enough vertical space. So you do that, and then once you put it on the indirect heat, you're just waiting for one notch below what you want to eat at. So if you want to eat it medium rare, you're taking it off at rare, knowing that in the 10 minutes that it spends in the foil, it will get you there. So anyway, no, do it right. Don't do it like me. Well, now I've kind of solved it, so you could do it like I do it now. But the chef went through that. We talked about goulash. I found my mother's goulash recipe, and which is funny. I'd scanned these cards I have. I'd scanned them, and I remembered it while we were talking. And then we also talked about big French fries. Big French fries. So anyway, I will post the images of those recipes for they became known as Kathleen McNamara's home runs, right? So, yeah, they got a name. And in fact, they were in a recipe book. I don't know who published it, but they were in a recipe book. My mom's initial recipe. She started doing it when I was a little kid. I can remember having them in Binghamton, New York. And she would take a loaf of French bread and she would slice it down the middle, and she would put ground beef, onion, green pepper, And I don't know if she initially put Worcestershire sauce and tomato sauce in it. But she would spoon this onto a piece of French bread, and then she would cover it in American cheese. She would put the French bread back together. She would put that back in the, you know, French bread foil sleeve. She would heat that up, pull it out, and then she would cut them in slices. And then slowly but surely, as my mom, you know, did, she would screw with the recipe, and she would she began to hollow the bread out a little bit. Too much bread, not enough, you know, not enough meat. And so she started scooping some of the bread out a little bit. And then she went to individually wrapped sandwiches, which she thought was better. And so no, they were one of my favorites growing up. I mean, all my mom's food was awesome. But as I said, my friends would come from near and far to eat those things. So we talked about that. And then the French fries. And Kim talks about how to make great, like, whole French fries, which is taking a potato and cutting it in quarters. You know, potato wedges, I think they're called in a lot of restaurants. But that. So anyway, a wonderful show on a Friday. And just on a personal note, you know, the weeks that I go do post-traumatic winning, the way it's evolved, and then on Wednesday, you know, the guy who introduced it was, for the third time, was a captain by the name of Jacques Lammer. And Jacques is an instructor at the Air Force Academy. He was a hockey player there, but was not supposed to get in because he struggled with depression as a high school kid. And so, you know, he introduced it. So doing that with somebody who I've known since he was 11 years old is always awesome. And then, sadly, his sisters flew in, I think, Wednesday night. I wasn't able to see Monique and Jocelyn, but they were speaking at the Air Force Academy the following day and in a program that that they came down to talk about leadership and whatnot. So pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff this week. So on a personal note, exciting stuff, and it's only going to get better. As I said, I had a long conversation with the sergeant major of the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, and post-traumatic winning going to be seen by all the sergeants majors as they get together from around the country. And then hopefully that's going to open up more doors. And the cool thing about doing it with the Guard is they'll take it back to their communities, which opens a whole bunch of doors there too. So exciting stuff, and slower than I want it to happen, but it's happening nonetheless. So very cool, and going to go to Orlando next week, and really excited about that to do some work for the Air Force. So this keeps getting better, and so thank you for listening today, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. Don't be afraid, as always, to change somebody's life, and you have all the tools required to go ahead and do that. So have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. I believe Alex Holling's going to join me on Monday. But on a Friday, All Marine Radio, over, and go change somebody's life.